From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, after months of rule by an interim government, Peru got closer to electing a new president. The April 8th vote narrowed the field of candidates to just two. Alejandro Toledo and former President Alan Garcia will now face each other in a runoff election in a year when it seems the government has loosened its grip on the media.
Lucian Chauvin, a freelance journalist in Lima, joins us now. Lucian, what a difference a year makes. When On the Media last spoke to you during the Peruvian presidential elections a year ago, the coverage in Peruvian broadcast media was so slanted against the opposition, it almost seemed like it had been bought and paid for by Alberto Fujimori's government. Now it turns out that...
Indeed, it was bought and paid for.
What happened?
Beginning in 1996, 1997, when Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori, decided he was going to run for a third term last year, his government began devising a plan to take control of the media. Basically, what this entailed was buying off the station owners with sumptuous sums of money.
And this wasn't simply revealed. This was actually videotaped. The whole country got to witness this. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, Fujimori's national security advisor, Vladimir Montesinos, had a penchant for taping everything and all of the people who passed through his office over the past few years. When Fujimori's government collapsed in November and he fled to Japan, raids on Montesinos' house and investigations into the National Security Service turned up thousands of videos. There are four television station owners shown taking bribes. In the case of Channel 4, which is America Television here, there is a video of father and son Cruciat, the owners, taking $1.5 million in small bills. There are also tapes of them discussing how they'll slant the news coverage. In the case of Channel 13, which is owned by Genaro Delgado Parker, there's a video of him with Montesinos discussing how he can win court cases to see if the government would manipulate the courts in his favor. An Israeli-born Peruvian, Baruch Ifchir, his station was highly critical of the Fujimori administration. So in 1997, the government came up with a very interesting way to deal with him. They rescinded his nationality, and once he was no longer a Peruvian, they confiscated his station. When the new government came in, one of the first things they did was return Ifchir's station to him, and that obviously changed the focus of the station.
All right. And now the first round of elections is over. The runoff is upon us. How different were the elections this time viewed through the media prism?
Well, on a scale of 1 to 100, the improvement was 120. Not only did all of the stations cover all of the candidates, the government, through the National Election Bureau, offered all of the candidates free airspace on the radio and on television. In the runoff, which we all expect somewhere toward the end of May, again, the government will offer the candidates free access to television, and it's expected that the networks will continue the trend that we've seen in the last couple months, which is treating all candidates equally. They're trying to be very even-keeled to recuperate some of their credibility, because people watch the news here and have second thoughts about everything they see and they hear.
An interesting little quirk of this whole saga is that for whatever reason, the Fujimori government didn't bother compromising the cable channel N. But it was on channel N that the videos appeared. What's happened to channel N? Has it come out of this as a heroic institution in Peruvian media?
It has. You know, last year it won the Human Rights Coordinating Committee. It won their top prize for the work they did covering the elections last year and covering the collapse of the regime. The Fujimori government didn't pay attention to it because nationwide, I think there were only 400,000 households that received cable television. The government basically dismissed it as too small.
One final thing. Alejandro Toledo and Alan Garcia are now running for president in the runoff. Could you imagine a scenario if one of these men were to win the presidency, that history would repeat itself and one of them would appropriate Fujimori's methods for media control?
I highly doubt it. Garcia was president of Peru between 85 and 90, And one criticism that no one has ever lodged against him is trying to manipulate the press. The same with Alejandro Toledo. During the race last year, he knew full well that the media was being manipulated against him. He constantly mentioned that if he were to win, there would be full freedom of expression and full freedom of the press. So, no, at least with these two candidates, I really don't see any return to the past.
All right, Lucian, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Lucian Chauvin is a freelance journalist who works for Time magazine and the Miami Herald in Lima, Peru. As Peruvian television continued its renaissance this week, American broadcasters were struggling to squeeze a complex international story into rigid formats. The right versus left talk shows were ill-equipped to deal with the issue of American policy toward China because the issue doesn't break down neatly along party lines.
It's not surprising that the shoutfests would be flummoxed when it comes to diplomacy, but what was surprising was how CNN covered the story. In its first major foreign, or in CNN parlance, international story since its parent company merged with AOL, CNN reminded viewers why it's known as an international news gathering force. CNN was the only place that had footage of the 24 crew members boarding a plane out of China. It got the footage by hooking a video phone up to a car battery.
Unfortunately, the questions that CNN was asking were about as illuminating as the dome light on a Chevy Nova. Witness these four references that came within a 90-minute span on the day the spy plane's crew left China.
Who blinked first in this standoff?
Tonight, who blinked?
There was nothing to apologize for.
Also, did either country blink? The U.S. perspective and the Chinese viewpoint coming up in separate reports.
Well, I'm not going to try to say who blinked first, but I do think you have focused on the right words.
The right word, according to ex-Secretary of State George Shultz, the last voice you heard there, wasn't blink, but apology.
So why this focus on blinking? Let's see if it stands up to the scrutiny of On the Media's Punditron 2000, a device that chews up and digests the expostulations of the pundits and tells us what it all means.
According to the Punditron, what you're seeing is a consequence of CNN's bid to attract a bigger audience. Ratings have been declining, and news shows like Wolf Blitzer Reports, where we heard George Shultz, were designed to go head-to-head with Fox and MSNBC. Simplified discussion and hype-filled promos are part of the trend. That's where all the tough guy talk about blinking comes from.
I don't know. Maybe the Punditron's a traditionalist, but he can't help thinking that Bernard Shaw wouldn't be asking who blinked. Oh well, the video phone was pretty cool. Let's just hope that Christiane Amanpour has her own set of jumper cables.
To the Germans, he is Herr Papierklammer. In Spain, he is Señor Pedazo Molesto de Metal. But to millions of frustrated American computer users, he is simply Mr. Clippy, the paperclip with eyes that appears on the screen whenever you begin writing a letter using Microsoft Office.
Is there any way to turn that moronic paperclip off?
Memo to Bill Gates. If that paperclip pops up one more time,
I can't take that thing anymore. I quit.
Those opinions come from a website actually sponsored by Microsoft, OfficeClippy.com. The reason for Office Clippy, actually the reason behind the entire movement to force out Mr. Clippy, is to promote a new Microsoft product, Office XP. The big selling point for Office XP is the elimination of the paperclip that interrupts you with the phrase, "It looks like you're writing a letter," and then proceeds to watch you work, critically, blinking, periodically. Lisa Gurry joins me on the phone from Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington, where she is product manager of the Office line. Hello, Lisa.
Hi there.
Do you personally hate Clippy?
You know, I actually love the little guy, but I do know lots of people that don't. My husband, for example, told me, "I'm glad you're getting rid of that little guy."
What was the extent of the market research that suggested the public wasn't warming to Mr. Clippy?
Most of the research that we did was actually anecdotal. We saw a Conan O'Brien sketch, actually, where Clippy had been shot. And we've heard a lot of feedback from our customers as well that some were less than pleased with Clippy. So we thought we would have a little fun with this campaign.
Before this marketing campaign, could Microsoft employees confidently voice anti-Clippy sentiment?
Absolutely. We're a pretty, pretty free nation over here.
I see that you're answering my question. Sorry, I do that sometimes. Just go ahead.
We are a free-thinking company, actually, and many Microsoft employees did not like Clippy either.
The New York Times reports that Microsoft is spending $30 million to market Office XP, and $500,000 of that is earmarked for the Clippy campaign. All of this puts you in the odd position of trying to sell one Microsoft product by playing on public loathing of a feature of another Microsoft product.
It's an interesting approach, one that we actually haven't taken before. But we think it's a great way to highlight the improvements in Office XP while also showing that Microsoft does have a sense of humor.
But come on, can't you disable Mr. Clippy from the Office software that's already on most computers as opposed to buying a whole new product?
You can turn Clippy off in any version of Office. However, we are choosing this type of campaign really just to demonstrate or generate interest.
But I put it to you, Ms. Gurry. Why should we believe that the new Office XP will not have a similarly annoying feature that we'll only be able to get rid of by buying Office XXP?
Well, our goal definitely is to introduce features that people love. We don't want to...
I see you're ducking the question. Would you like some help with that?
Let me try again. Seriously, our goal is to introduce features that people love. In fact, when Clippy was first introduced, he was quite popular.
Which raises the question, has there been a Save Mr. Clippy backlash?
There hasn't been yet, but since we've just kicked off the campaign, it wouldn't surprise us. We think there are a lot of closet Clippy lovers out there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Gurry is product manager for Office XP, a Clippy-free zone.
It looks like you're writing a letter. Would you like some help along the way? Yeah, it looks like you're opening a spreadsheet now, Mama. That's the kind of thing I used to say. Child, I told you how to create a template that copies worksheet data to a database. But you just yelled at me to go away. It looks like you're writing a letter. I do believe I could format it better, but since you upgraded to XP, looks like you got no use for me.
Coming up, big media is set to get even bigger, and the rise of the scary female game show host.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Bush administration has shown a deregulatory bent in just about every area of governance, and that includes communications. Over the years, the FCC has imposed limits on how many media outlets one company could own because it feared that too much media concentration would strangle competition and diversity of viewpoints. But now that the demonstrably liberal FCC chairman Bill Kennard has been replaced by the decidedly conservative Michael Powell, big media sees a chance to cast off some of those constraints. What are those constraints? Here are a few of the big ones. A TV network is not allowed to reach more than 35% of American households with stations it owns and operates, and no broadcaster may own more than one station in most markets. Nor can the major networks own each other, and neither newspapers nor cable systems can own broadcast stations in the markets they serve. On Thursday, at the next public meeting of the FCC, broadcasters will be clamoring for change. Bill McConnell writes for Broadcasting and Cable magazine, Mr. McConnell, which of those rules are going to be challenged and who's going to be doing the challenging?
Well, all of these rules are being challenged right now. The one that's most likely to fall quickly is the dual network rule that prevents the big networks from owning each other or owning the WB or UPN.
So at the April 19th meeting, the question of UPN ownership comes up. Currently, the nation's biggest media company, Viacom, owns CBS and has been holding the ownership of UPN provisionally. It's supposed to sell it by May 4th. Viacom wants FCC to allow them to hold on to it and to some stations that go over the cap as well, right?
That's correct. The way it's going to be suggested to be changed at the April 19th meeting would let the big four networks acquire UPN or the WB.
What have been some of the consumer group challenges to that?
On this particular rule, there is not so much opposition because UPN is losing lots of money, and if Viacom was forced to sell it, it would probably go out of business.
And because UPN has a substantial black viewership, this would seem to hurt diversity even more on network television.
That's correct.
How about AOL Time Warner? That's the fourth largest media company. Last month, an appeals court struck down an FCC cable ownership rule that limited one company from reaching more than a third of the pay TV subscriber universe. And the court said the 30% cap violated the First Amendment. Where does that leave the rule?
Well, the FCC basically is under orders to rewrite it. The court did say you can have a rule, you can have a limit, but you need to justify it. Additionally, this court decision in March, if you look at it deeply, says that any type of restriction on media ownership has to pass really strict scrutiny because it violates their First Amendment rights to some degree. And if you're going to do that, you really have to justify it.
What is the net effect if these rules go away?
I think the net effect is you're going to see a lot of our most prominent broadcast and cable organizations controlled by one, two, three, maybe four companies.
How is that different from the way it is now?
Well, in each industry, there might be that many number of big players. And also when it comes to broadcast radio and TV, there are still quite a few number of independent owners, even though there's only a handful of networks. Each of the TV stations in your market might be owned by affiliates rather than the networks themselves.
How would the average consumer be able to perceive this change? What would the net effect be on him or her?
Well, it's hard to predict because in the radio market, there's been massive consolidation since 1996 when Congress lifted the ownership cap just on radio. You've seen that in radio markets across the country that the largest station groups now own four or five stations in every big town. The listener might not really notice any difference because if you're a station group and you own four or five stations in town, you're not going to run two or three classic rock stations. You're going to have a country, classic rock, hip-hop, whatever. You're going to try to diversify the holdings within your own group. So even though there's tighter control among the owners, there might be more diversity among the type of format. So the listeners might not really be able to tell right off. But I think what it does mean in other areas, you see more of the shock jock type of stuff and sort of these big moneymaker type of formats, less emphasis on news, that sort of thing.
What is the likelihood that any of these rules or all of these rules will be changed?
Well, I think there's a great likelihood that almost all of them will be changed in some way. The Powell Commission is going to be a lot more deregulatory. It's the way Chairman Powell's leaning now, and the Republican appointees that will join the commission in the next few months lean the same way he does.
But as you laid out the situation in radio, in the rest of broadcasting, if these rules are lifted or tremendously relaxed, you're going to have one, two, or three voice towns for broadcasters.
That's a good point, and I think the consumer advocates are, I think, very frustrated at this point because they see the idea that diversity of ownership has value in itself is just being something pushed aside. Chairman Powell himself argues that just because you have diversity of ownership doesn't mean you have real diversity of viewpoint, because what's the difference between one rich person and another?
He's saying that, but he doesn't seem to keep the rich from getting bigger and more dominant in the marketplace of ideas.
That's correct. You might want to ask an advocate, I guess, what the dangers of that are.
Bill McConnell, thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Bill McConnell is the FCC reporter for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine.
Speaking of corporate media, the On the Media corporate anthem we aired last week inspired surprising appreciation from some of you. Listener David Parr of Dallas, Texas, took his admiration one step further. In honor of his current employer's impending merger with a California-based company called Maxim, Mr. Parr wrote his very own corporate anthem.
Cannot wait till this merger goes through. This is a song for our new Maxim overlords. You'll always be right home with us. I hope the layoffs are pretty slim. Don't tell Bob, it's probably him.
Well, thank you, David. That was both haunting and extremely pitiful.
Our discussion of Dan Rather's appearance at a Democratic Party fundraiser drew plenty of responses. Alan Neuner from Boonetown, New Jersey, wrote, "Journalists are like every other citizen, entitled to their own opinions, biases, and beliefs." Jonathan Sando of Fremont, California, agreed and added, "The media's lack of credibility has more to do with what it hides than what it reveals." Larry Tagrin of Montgomery Village, Maryland, dismissed the entire matter out of hand. Dan Rather isn't even a journalist, he says. He is what the BBC more honestly referred to as a newsreader. He is a personality figurehead who reads a script. As a footnote to our continuing coverage of Professor Gore's adventures at the Columbia School of Journalism, William Lutz, a real professor at Rutgers University, wants us to ask, is there a syllabus for this course? Are there any writing assignments? Are there any exams? On what basis will the students be graded?
And finally, a listener in need of reassurance. Eric Pierce from Bellevue, Washington, confessed to feeling a trifle molested by the April 9th issue of Newsweek. The magazine listed as a catchphrase the tagline from NBC's not-yet-aired game show, The Weakest Link. How can a catchphrase predate its source, he asks. And he also wonders if there's some sort of sneaky synergy going on between GE, that owns NBC, and the Washington Post Company that owns Newsweek. Well, the answer is no, there is no financial connection anyway between those two companies. But speaking of cross-promotion, next up, On the Media's London correspondent Gareth Mitchell offers this report on The Weakest Link.
The two biggest shows in the United States over the last few years have been ABC's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and CBS's Survivor. NBC is a latecomer to the reality TV party, but now it thinks it has the magic formula to bring together the best of its rivals.
Welcome to The Weakest Link. Any of the nine people in the studio here today could win up.
It's obvious that The Weakest Link is a quiz show, but according to host Anne Robinson, the survivor aspect plays a prominent role.
There was a book written by an American anthropologist about 20 years ago called The Mountain People, which showed that if you sent people into the wilderness, they went back into sort of warrior-like frames of mind, and they were like savages. And there's a certain amount of the savage character about those who come on The Weakest Link, as far as I'm concerned.
The Mountain People, written by Colin Turnbull. Remember that piece of trivia if you find yourself a contestant on the show, which Stuart Krasnow, executive producer of the US version, says has a pace all of its own.
We have more questions answered in a single round than Millionaire has in an entire hour, and we have six vote-offs in an hour as opposed to Survivor. So I kind of like to say what Weakest Link offers you is a much quicker pace, a much faster energy.
In the show, team members answer a steady stream of questions to bank as much money as they can.
Richard, Eric Weiss was the real name of which famous escapologist?
Harry Houdini.
Correct. Joyce, in the animal kingdom, what air for long-legged birds famed for their pink-tinged plumage that live entirely by filter feeding?
Flamingos.
Correct, Andy. In literature, does the Cheshire Cat or the Cornish Cat appear in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland?
Cheshire Cat.
Correct, Andy.
If someone gets a question wrong, the bank balance goes back to zero and the team has to start the chain all over again. At the end of each round, the contestants vote off one player.
It's time to vote off The Weakest Link.
Eventually, when only two contestants are left, they play head-to-head to decide who's going to go home with the money. until The Weakest Link, Anne Robinson was best known on UK television as a consumer watchdog. Now she's brought her notorious upfront attitude to the quiz show format.
I've campaigned for years about patronising viewers and having cheesy television where hosts pretend they're somebody's new best friend. They've known them for 30 seconds.
And what's actually going on there when you are so upfront and rude to the contestants? Is that really you?
I think I'm direct. I think we get to the point quickly.
Sam, what do you do?
I'm studying at Bristol University.
Are you? What year are you in?
My last year.
Your last year and you can't answer any general knowledge?
No.
In the UK's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, host Chris Tarrant is similarly unkind to contestants. He just loves making them sweat. ABC preferred to leave Chris in London and opt for homegrown, much gentler host Regis Philbin. By contrast, for The Weakest Link, NBC is sticking with Scary Anne. The US version's executive producer, Phil Gurran, thinks American viewers will warm to her cold-hearted approach.
She's real, but she's also a unique character. She's actually going to say things that you're thinking about when you're watching TV. She's our audience surrogate.
The contestants are left to fend for themselves. I caught up with some recently during taping of the show at the BBC studios in London.
It was really good that we answered all our questions right in the first round. But then on the other hand, you're also competing against people. So the further the rounds go on, the more obvious that becomes.
The whole thing is a fairly pleasant experience as a contestant, but I was just wishing I hadn't told all of my friends that I was going to be on it.
I think it's Anne that really makes the show, and that's why people want to go on it. And Anne's there, and you're worried about what she's going to say, and it makes me very nervous.
Here in the UK, The Weakest Link has provided the nation with a national catchphrase. It makes Anne Robinson rather proud.
It's now gone into the language here because the Prime Minister referred to the Leader of the Opposition by saying, "You're the weakest link." Someone calls the Transport Minister the weakest link. You'll hear children talking about the weakest link. And I'm told that I'm the most favourite character to impersonate at fancy dress parties.
Before a single edition of the show has aired in the United States, it's too early to say if The Weakest Link is going to be a major ratings hit. But maybe that catchphrase is set to join "Is That Your Final Answer?" and "The Tribe Has Spoken" as everyday phrases. It was used to great effect as a punchline on last week's Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live, of course, airs on NBC, which will be airing the first episode of The Weakest Link on Monday. For On The Media, this is Gareth Mitchell in London.
Kevin doesn't think you're up to scratch, nor do the rest of us. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. That couple of seconds has cost you your place. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. You are the weakest link. You are the weakest link. You are the weakest link. Goodbye. Why did you come here today?
To see you, Anne, really.
Well, I hope you've had a good look, because with two votes, you are the weakest link. Goodbye.
Among the ways The Weakest Link breaks tradition is the very presence of a female host. The $64,000 question may be, why do all these game show jobs go to men? Chris Sollentrop wrote the article Classic Concentration for the online magazine Slate and traced the history of female game show hosts. Chris, Anne Robinson may be one of a kind, but I gather she's not the first.
She is not. The Sally Ride, if you will, of game show hosts is Arlene Francis, a woman who hosted a show called Blind Date from 1949 to 1952. She was really most famous for being a panelist on What's My Line, but she did host that show for 3 years. You know, there's a lot of hosts, male hosts, that we have sort of iconic status in American culture. Bob Barker, Wink Martindale, Chuck Woolery, Alex Trebek, Pat Sajak. No woman host rises to that level in our collective memory.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Chuck Woolery told Newsweek in 1975, "Emceeing a game show is the dream of every DJ in America, and that's who's got the job, disc jockeys and television has-beens." But the question I asked is, shouldn't women have the right to be TV has-beens too?
So Arlene Francis had a 3-year run, not bad. She clearly wasn't a failure.
Yes.
How did it come to pass that so many of her successors were men?
That's a great question. There were a few other women in the early 50s, the heyday of game shows when they were on prime time before the quiz show scandals. Gypsy Rose Lee actually hosted a show for a few months. There was a woman named Vera Vague who hosted a couple shows that were unsuccessful. And then the game shows fell off the map. and so did women hosts. And when they came back, the people that produced these shows for this new daytime audience, which was a largely female audience, I think they assumed that they would want to see these toothy guy Smileys hosting the show.
All right, but the game shows are no longer the province merely of daytime television. Why do the networks or the producers persist in hiring men?
Well, one, you know, TV producers, as people in most industries, I think have a bias for what works and what they're used to, and so that's part of it. In 1983, Betty White started hosting a show called Just Men. She actually won a daytime Emmy for that. And then since then, there have been a handful of hosts, more than there were in the 60s and 70s, which was practically zero. But women tend to host shows that are very stereotypical gender role shows. They host shows in which they're matchmakers, or they're cooks, or they're babysitters. It's very rare for a woman to host a quiz show, which Anne Robinson is doing.
All right, so comes now Anne Robinson. She's busted through the gender barrier. Her persona on the show is quite aggressive. She actually will say some nasty and demeaning things to the contestants who fail. Is there any explanation for the fact that America isn't comfortable with women game show hosts, apparently, as the sort of smiley, toothy presence of authority, but seems quite comfortable with them as scolds, like Dr. Laura or Judge Judy, whose abrasiveness is part of their shtick?
That's really true. I hadn't thought about that. Women are well ensconced on daytime television as you know, warm, fuzzy Oprahs or Rosies, but I suppose they're also Judge Judys and Dr. Lauras.
While having a primetime game show may, on the face of it, be some sort of victory for women's rights, it may be a dubious victory.
Yes,
after all.
Yes. But it does say something about the culture. It's good that, I mean, women used to be worse than hostesses. They used to be dancing cigarette packs or pirate girls on these game shows. And so it says quite a bit about where women have moved in the past 50 years to have a woman hosting a primetime game show.
Well, I guess for the moment, we'll just be grateful. Thank you, Chris Sullentrop. I'm sorry you don't win on the media, but you do get to take home a home version of our game, as well as a case of turtle wax and 144 boxes of Lee Press-On nails. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
Chris Sullentrop is an editor at Slate.com.
Coming up, content codes for broadcasters, comic books, and dirty movies, and CBS gives golf fans the bird.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout the programming day of February 21st, Fox News Channel ran a promo featuring an exclusive interview with Linda Tripp on their talk show Hannity and Combs. Fox made that claim despite the fact that Tripp had been interviewed by Charles Gibson the day before on ABC's Good Morning America. And that was just a month after ABC's News Magazine 2020 had promoted its own interview with Tripp, with correspondent Nancy Collins, as an exclusive. Exclusive. Even though Collins had also interviewed Tripp for the December issue of George Magazine, which, of course, prominently slapped exclusive on the cover. In journalism, the word exclusive isn't all that exclusive anymore. So now, the latest installment in our Word Watch series, where we examine the media's overuse and abuse of certain words, on the media's John Solomon gives us exclusive.
Tonight, a Dateline Court TV network exclusive. Was it a tragic teenage...
Exclusive used to mean having a story that no one else had, a scoop, breaking news, but the definition has expanded. Take the cover of Newsweek's February 26th edition. It featured the headline, Sleepless Nights and Secret Pardons, the inside story of Bill's last days. In block letters slugged at the top of the page was, exclusive. Yet most of the article turned out to be information that could be found in other places. Newsweek senior editor Deirdre Depke acknowledges that the term's meaning has broadened. No longer just a scoop or a story that only one news organization has. Exclusive now can mean unique or definitive. Depke says that's why the Clinton Inside story was exclusive.
The story did have the narrative tale of Clinton's final days in office that I think was exclusive. It did contain information that had not been reported before. And frankly, it was written and presented in a way that no one else had tried to do and really was quite definitive.
Newsweek also trumpeted as exclusive three interviews it had with Ariel Sharon, even though he had made himself available periodically to the Israeli media. Depke says that Newsweek's three interviews were American exclusives, a distinction that the magazine did not feel important to explain to its readers.
For the reader, the point is you're delivering a very important interview with a critical person, and I don't really care if you're calling it an exclusive for the third time. They know that it's significant.
Typical of the sliding standard for exclusives was Larry King's intro to his March 26 show with new Texas Tech University basketball coach Bobby Knight.
Tonight, the most controversial coach in college basketball is sporting new team colors. An exclusive hour with Bob Knight, now of Texas Tech University. We'll take your calls and along with us.
This exclusive came only 2 days after Knight held a press conference covered by most of the media organizations in the Western world. Using that same criterion, the press could promote practically every one-on-one interview as exclusive. And it usually does, in an effort to pump up its stories in the increasingly competitive marketplace. But what is the effect on the consumer of exclusivity inflation?
Well, I think what happens is you'll get your viewer, and as soon as he realizes or she realizes, I've seen this, they flick off.
Scotty Williston is a former CBS deputy foreign editor and a visiting professor at the Columbia School of Journalism.
So they might have great numbers at the start of something, but they don't sustain it. And people don't pay any attention to it. It's how many people look down and really pay attention to that exclusive on a tabloid in a supermarket. I think there's definite cost to news coverage.
In that spirit, On the Media wants to be clear that this report is not an entirely exclusive analysis of the term exclusive. In March, Brill's content included a story about how Vanity Fair magazine misused the word exclusive on some of its photos. So, with an electronic media exclusive on the word exclusive, this is John Solomon for On the Media.
Broadcasters who are mindful of the FCC know not to say the seven dirty words. But in terms of keeping the regulators at bay, they don't have a whole lot else to go on. The FCC lent a guiding hand to shock jocks and other broadcasters last week when it presented some new guidelines using transcripts of actual broadcasts. The examples cited were termed either indecent or not indecent, which is how the government says decent when it doesn't want to sound like it's endorsing Geraldo Rivera's Unlocking the Great Mysteries of Sex. For example, consider the drive-time duo of Stevens and Pruitt on KLOL Houston. They didn't use any dirty words per se, but the way they said the word big did not sit well with the commissioners. Stevens and Pruitt's use of big was apparently so titillating that the segment was deemed indecent. Then there's this song. When San Diego's KGB-FM replayed this Monty Python ditty, the FCC ruled indecent. I quote now from the report. The song was found to be actionably indecent despite English accent and ambient noise because the lyrics were sufficiently understandable. Are you paying attention, British vulgarians? No matter how charming and sophisticated the accent, you will find no safe harbor here! On the other hand, an announcer using one of the seven dirty words after botching a news report was found to be not indecent. Other examples of not indecent broadcasting, an Oprah Winfrey show on relationships, and NPR's own Mike Schuster, who filed a report on John Gotti wiretaps with expletives not deleted, was also found not indecent. Mike Schuster, how do you feel being turned into a teaching guide from the FCC?
If my story affects one shock jock or one mafia don, I'll have done my job.
Context and moderation seem to have guided the FCC. Most of the examples ruled indecent ranged from dumb to disgusting. For instance, we feel no pressing need to play the uterus song. As for the examples ruled not indecent, Schindler's List, for example, most of them would offend only the most Victorian sensibilities. The consequence is that the FCC's new guidelines may still be too vague to alter any behavior in the real world. But that doesn't mean the government watchdogs don't matter. Some entertainment industries are trying to steer clear of the hounds by regulating themselves.
For example, Paul Cambria is an attorney who represents some of the biggest players in the field of pornography, VCA Pictures, Vivid Video, Hustler, and Video Team. Mr. Cambria, welcome to the show.
The adult entertainment field.
I stand corrected.
Pornography field. Thank you.
Now, in these times when conservatives, notably Attorney General John Ashcroft, hold the reins of power, there has been an urge to do a little self-policing. You've helped at least one company draw up a list of box cover and movie production guidelines.
One of my clients had asked me, can you tell us the subjects that are the most frequent subjects for prosecution? And the next thing you know, they produced a written list, which included some of the things that I said and a number of things that they put on the list themselves.
Keeping in mind that this is a family program, sort of, can you go over some of the elements that at least one company has posted and said that they'll try to avoid?
They were things such as group sex, pictures of individuals engaging in so-called bondage or sadomasochistic activities. It seems as if the more unusual variety of sexual activities that occur, the more likely it'll be selected for prosecution.
Isn't adult entertainment the place where, beyond all others, the market is arguably supposed to prevail? I mean, what's the point of a list like this?
The point of the list was to advise my clients the things that may get prosecuted. Whether or not they're successfully prosecuted, it's a different story. I think that's what you're referring to is, you know, if it doesn't offend the law, what's the point? Well, because you may still get charged, even though the jury ultimately says you did not violate the law, and some people want to avoid even being charged.
And so, as you say, what some of your companies are anticipating or trying to forestall is a step up in what amounts to these nuisance suits in the Bush administration.
They really don't know what's going to happen with the Bush administration. Whether or not the people in the administration will realize that the general public does not have prosecution of adult materials for adults as a high priority. And we can see that by the literally billions, with a B, of dollars spent each year on adult material. I think that's a pretty strong message to any administration that, you know, the adult public feels that this material is legitimate for them to consume, and the government should spend their money, you know, fighting street crime, drug crime, and violent crime, rather than trying to tell people what movies they can watch at home on their VCR or on their satellite station.
How much of the industry do you think will take notice of this list?
Oh, I think the whole industry has taken notice of it. Some people have decided that the list really means don't do this. Other people have decided the list means this is obscene. Other people have taken the position that the large companies made up this list because they don't produce any material with these subjects in them. And so they're just trying to put the small companies that do produce this kind of material out of business. I mean, it seems like everybody has decided for themselves what they're going to do with this so-called list.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Paul Cambria is an attorney who represents the adult entertainment industry. Self-regulation is almost always motivated by self-preservation. One of the best examples is the creation of the Comic Books Authority. In 1954, the entertainment industries were feeling the chill of McCarthyism. Enemies of the comic book were testifying on Capitol Hill. Retailers were getting nervous. So the industry self-imposed a content code to be monitored by the Comics Code Authority, still operating today. Michael Silberkite is the publisher of Archie Comics. He remembers when his father helped to create the Comics Code Authority.
What happened was that the retailers who handled comic magazines and the distributors who handled comic magazines were so worried that the government, the Senate committees, would come down on them, similar to what they did with the blacklisting of communists, that they refused to handle all comic books. In those days, every comic book that was printed and sold to the distributor, then to the retailer, was fully returnable. So you lived on the percentage of the sales of your magazines, and, you know, you had a breaking point, and if you sold less, you lost money.
Hence the Comics Code Authority.
There's no doubt in my mind that overnight the industry would have been wiped out, absolutely gone, because people didn't want to handle comic books.
But the bar has been raised enormously on violent media, even violent media for children. Why is there still a need for a comics code?
Well, you have to segue now from 1954 to 2001. I mean, things have changed dramatically over the years. The original code, you could not show a tiger jumping out of the bushes at a hunter with his claws and his fangs showing, which is kind of ridiculous by today's standards, but it certainly wasn't ridiculous by 1954 standards. If you look at the current code, it has reference to things like you should not denigrate the police department, the teachers, your family, the government. You shouldn't make fun of any ethnic groups or any kind of sexual preferences and things like that. We at Archie feel that we are definitely responsible publishers. We feel that we have an obligation to the children of America and the world who read our comic books to see that there is nothing objectionable to children.
Okay, but the fact is that Archie doesn't need a comics code authority. You don't expect to see Veronica and Reggie, you know, going at it in the back of the family Chevrolet, but some of the code doesn't seem to relate at all to the sorts of comics that are out there that might actually feel constrained by a code. For example, the code says that female characters should be drawn realistically without any exaggeration of physical qualities. And meanwhile, characters like Catwoman or the She-Hulk seem to personify such exaggerations. Does anybody really follow this code?
Oh, yes. As far as Catwoman being a little sexually explicit or whatever you want to call it, or provocative, I guess you have to say that these are drawn characters. They're not real characters. Look at the 6 o'clock news. What do you see 6 o'clock news when everybody's watching television?
Wait a minute. You have a comics code. This code is supposed to ride herd over comics. Comics are drawn characters. That's what you're supposed to be looking at when the code talks about exaggerating physical characteristics, and you have a picture that exaggerates it naturally. Comics are pictures.
Well, the only answer I can give to that then is if it is in violation of the code, the code administrator, their responsibility is to show this to the editor and say you have to tone it down, you have to change it, or you cannot put the seal on it.
Okay, what about the rule that says scenes of excessive violence shall not be presented? Some of the most popular Comics Code Authority-approved titles or characters such as Wolverine, Deadpool, The Punisher, they're incredibly violent.
They may be violent, but I don't believe they're excessively violent. Pick up some of the books that don't have the seal on it, and you'll see the difference. You'll see people ripping people's hearts out, ripping heads off. I don't think you'll see that in code-approved adventure, what we call adventure comic books.
How much is the code an effort of the comics industry to self-regulate, and how much of it is a reaction to the demands of retailers such as Walmart that will carry the titles?
Well, I think a lot of the code is to protect itself from the overreaction. I can tell you that most retailers like Walmart, Kmart, Target, Walden Books will not handle comic books that do not have the comics code of the comics seal on it. First of all, we're all in business to stay in business and not be put out of business.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Brooke, all about comic books.
Michael Silberkite is the publisher of Archie Comics and the former head of the Comics Magazine Association of America, which created the Comics Code Authority.
If you said to me, "Bob, what's your favorite bird song?" you'd have me stumped. I don't know a goldfinch from a condor. To me, cataloging bird sounds is approximately like collecting stamps, which to me is like cataloging bird sounds. It's not that I don't appreciate nature, but I think it's best kept outside. Fortunately, however, everyone isn't like me, which is how CBS got caught last year overdubbing recorded bird songs to add pastoral beauty to its golf broadcasts. Joining us now to get to the bottom of the story is Ken Hullinga of the American Birding Association. Ken, how on earth did the birders notice this?
Birders almost subconsciously listen to the bird sounds they hear on TV. Most people kind of ignore them. They're part of the background noise. But to people interested in birds, you sort of can't help but pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, it happens that today we have another special guest. I'd like you to hear from him.
Ah, I know that guest. That's a canyon wren. As wrens go, fairly attractive-looking wren. They're native to the western and southwestern United States.
Well, exactly. I don't know if you would call it the smoking gun, but it's definitely a whistleblower because it was that song heard during a broadcast of the Buick Open, which is played in Michigan, that alerted birders to the fact that CBS was sweetening its broadcast soundtracks with sounds of birds that were not indigenous to the area. The canyon wren, of course, as we both know, would never be found in Michigan. Is that right?
That's true.
What did they take us for to put it such an obviously out-of-context bird song in that golf tournament?
You know, we hear out-of-place birds all the time. Commercials are full of songs of morning warblers. People are sitting around their backyards grilling on their barbecues. And while that is a bird of primarily the East, they certainly don't hang around people's backyards.
Now, during the Masters tournament last weekend, we again heard some bird songs. Let's hear from our second very special guest. Sound familiar?
That's the one. It's a Carolina wren.
Now, do you believe that maybe they were sweetening the audio again, only this time with a bird that was appropriate to the venue?
Certainly Carolina wrens are present in that area and probably nest on that golf course. It would seem a little odd that the bird would be singing with that many people milling around, but it's certainly a little bit suspicious.
Ken Hullinga, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Ken Hullinga is with the American Birding Association in Washington, D.C. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk and Kathleen Horan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.